members and guests, we are going to get this meeting of the House Commerce Committee going here, and I don't think we quite have a quorum yet, but we are going to start with Representative Schultz's bill, because we don't need a quorum for that. We are going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus liquor bill.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Davids.
Does this bill have to do with the golf course?
Representative Davids, I believe it does.
Could I move it then?
Representative Davids, would you please move this bill?
I'll move the bill.
Thank you. Representative Davids moves House File 1502. And with that, Representative Schultz, welcome to the committee. Please tell us why you're here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This is House File 1502. It would allow the City of Duluth to issue a liquor license for Lester Park Golf Course in the Lester Park neighborhood of Duluth. This golf course is owned and has been operated by the City of Duluth, so it's a public golf course. And now we're seeking to engage a private company to manage the operations. There's not been a liquor license at the golf course because the clubhouse is in the portion of the City of Duluth.
Representative Schultz, I appreciate your comments, but as a freshman with your first time before the committee, I see no treats. So we're going to that's okay, because we're just going to reserve patio time at the golf course for members of the committee.
That sounds good.
Can I rescind my motion?
No. Representative Davids, we're good.
I thought that was the first time in any committee. I didn't know it was the first time in every committee.
No.
I stand corrected.
No, we're good with the patio time. All of the guests in the audience would like to be there as well. So thank you, Representative Schultz. We appreciate that. Please proceed. Sorry, I'll never interrupt.
That's okay.
Again.
This is in the portion of the City of Duluth that was annexed in the 20th century and was established as a dry neighborhood. So part of the golf course is within this restricted zone and part of the golf course is outside of it. What happens at the clubhouse is in the restricted zone, and so we are seeking permission to have a liquor license at the clubhouse. The bill relates only to the golf course itself and not the surrounding neighborhood. So I have with me Daniel Fanning. He's from the City of Duluth, who can provide information and answer questions on the bill. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman,
please proceed.
Members,
we're ready.
Thank you very much. My name is Daniel Fanning. I'm the Communications and Government Relations Director for the City of Duluth. On behalf of the Mayor, thank you for this opportunity, and thank you, Representative Schultz. Representative Schultz sums it up really well. To put some numbers on it, just to give you a perspective, the city currently owns two golf courses, Anger Park Golf Course and Lester Park Golf Course. Anger Park Golf Course, in general, has been profitable. Lester has not. A big reason for that, given some of the concerns that we've looked at over the last couple of years, is that the fact is we can't sell liquor at Lester Park Golf Course. So we've looked at the numbers at Anger Park, and we see that on average they average between $50,000 and $60,000 just in direct liquor sales every year. In addition to a number of conferences and meetings that are held at Anger Tower, we're confident that the numbers more reflective around $120,000. Last year alone, Lester lost about $140,000. So in addition to getting a liquor license, what we also did was hire a new management firm, Billy Casper Golf, one of the top golf companies in the country, to come in. They're going to be starting actually just next week. The first person's going to be hired. So we want to give them all the tools at their disposal to take this from the red to the black and make this profitable. This would allow us to do this. And we have some more financial numbers if you have any questions, but we appreciate the opportunity to be heard.
Thank you, Mr. Fanning. Members, any questions? Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative and the testifier, have folks in the neighborhood, have they chimed in? I mean, has there been some outreach to them about moving this forward? And if so, what has been their comments?
Mr. Fanning or Representative Schultz.
Sure. Thanks, Mr. Chair and Representative. We've held this bill back to get input from the community, and so far I've received extremely positive input from the community, except for one constituent. So I've been working really closely with the city council member who represents this neighborhood, and we work together to get input from the community, and they seem very supportive of it. This bill simply gives the city council the ability to vote on it. So my argument was that it's easier for constituents in Duluth to go to the city council meeting and show their support or their non-support of it at the city council meeting rather than coming to the Capitol. So this just gives the ability for the city council to vote it up or down.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Members, any other questions? Anybody else in the audience want to testify? Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. More just kind of a pedestrian question, and I should know this after a few years of this, but I'm wondering why we have to do all of these at the state level. I mean, and is it a new license authority or new permission, new authority to a city, and that's the reason, or?
Representative Loon, Mr. McCormick, do you want to come up and talk to us about that, or Mr. Kleeman, whatever you think? This question almost every year.
Well,
Representative Schultz?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Loon, Duluth is kind of unique because it has this annexed clause that says that it has to be a dry neighborhood. So I know you've been hearing other licenses. This is a completely unique situation, I think, from the other bills that you've been hearing about liquor licenses and golf courses.
Representative Schultz and Representative Loon, I think we'll hear from Mr. McCormick on this, because we have this question pretty much every year. Why does the legislature even need to be involved in, you know, what should be really city decisions? And with that, we'll turn it over to Mr. McCormick.
Madam Chair, members, in the old days, the city or county was regulated as to the absolute number of liquor licenses they could have. Several years ago, we deregulated and allowed city and counties to set their own licenses. However, we still have location requirements about where what can be licensed, and golf courses, for example, this year are an example of an organization that can't be generally licensed by a city, and therefore we need a special liquor license provision for each of those. And if you might remember, a few years ago, universities were a category that could not just be generally licensed by a city, and so in each case we would have to do a special, and we crafted a general allowance. We've also had small ballparks for town baseball. And so if there's enough golf course licensees, we could discuss whether that might be worth a general law at some point. But there are different issues in each case why we don't allow a general license.
Thank you, Mr. McCormick.
Thank you.
Representative Loon, you good?
Yep, I'm good. Thank you,
right.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We are now official. We have a quorum, members, so this bill has been moved by Representative Davids officially before us. Representative Schultz, we'll give you the final word.
I just want to thank Mr. Chair, the Chair, and members of the committee for listening to this bill, and I urge you to support it.
That sounds very good. And with that, we will lay House File 1502 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus liquor bill. Thank you,
thank
Mr.
you.
Fanning. Thank you, Representative Schultz. Nice job. Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1026 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Representative Swidzinski. I was just looking around for somebody to move that. Thank you. Representatives. Representative Swidzinski, I appreciate your motion. We are not going to have this for possible inclusion. We're going to move it on to the Committee on Jobs and Energy. We are going to re-refer it, so I assume you're okay with
yes,
that motion?
Yes, that's what I meant. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Representative Swidzinski. Representative Erickson, welcome to the committee. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I haven't been here for eons, so it's great to be here, and thank you for hearing House
Representative Erickson, we've missed you, and for members that haven't been here for eons, they usually bring treats.
Well, I like the idea of a patio party, so...
All right. Thank you, Representative
Erickson.
Please proceed.
And join me on my patio in Mille Lacs County, and that's what this bill is about today. It's about a local control for Mille Lacs County, which is my home county, in regard to the state building code. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have you hear from Commissioner Dave Oslin and from Lands Services Director Michelle McPherson. And I think Commissioner wants to go first.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Commissioner, please identify yourself for the record and proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dave Oslin, Mille Lacs County Commissioner. Thank you for this opportunity to address our county's concerns about the state building code enforcement. I'm here today as Mille Lacs County Commissioner from the 5th District, which covers four townships and three towns that border Mille Lacs Lake. Our county board has heard from citizens loud and clear that they feel overregulated and would like to remove the requirement for the enforcement of building code. This input came up repeatedly during efforts to revise our county's comprehensive plan in 2011. Mille Lacs County Board recognized the need for updating the current county comprehensive plan, which was then 20 years old. The County Board appointed members and hired a facilitator, Jordan Zeller, from East Central Regional Development Commission, and the Mille Lacs County Comprehensive Plan Steering Committee was commissioned. The project assigned to the committee was to develop a new and updated comprehensive plan to guide the county in strategic planning for the future. The steering committee had broad representation, consisting of 14 members, including representatives from County Board, Planning Commission, Board of Adjustments, Township officials, county administrator, land service director, county sheriff, and private citizens. Representative Erickson was in the loop during the process. As a county commissioner, I served on that steering committee. The purpose of the new comprehensive plan is to promote and support public health, safety, and welfare of the residents while advocating the rights of property ownership, recognizing the primacy of property rights, and the sanctity of private property ownership, enunciated in the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and Articles 1, Section 7 and 13 of the Minnesota Constitution. The process was quite robust and welcomed input from a variety of sources. We held monthly meetings open to the public with the emphasis on private citizen input. We held five rounds of community meetings in numerous locations over a two-year period. There were public hearings held. These were facilitated by our consultant, and we had great attendance. We solicited input from 3,900 surveys mailed out to random sampling of residents.
Thank you.
Early in 2012, this survey was available on the county's website. We had a very high response rate, 25%, which told us people were interested and invested in the process. 1,005 paper surveys were returned, 124 surveys completed online. And finally, there was 9 ad hoc citizens task force groups that served. Each of these included about 10 members. After 3 years, this input was consolidated into a final report and adopted by the county board in November of 2013. The plan is intended to give guidance for many years to come to county decision makers based on residents' inputs and goals. During the process, it became very clear over and over that the citizens felt overregulated. One of the current themes heard from all sectors providing input was that the building code enforcement seemed inappropriate for Mille Lacs County. We are a low-income, non-metro county. Poverty is much higher in Mille Lacs County than the rest of Minnesota, 12.4 versus 10.6%. as our medium household values. In addition, no counties near us are subject to building code enforcement. While enforcement may not seem significant to metropolitan counties, in Mille Lacs County it adds to the negative perception that our citizens have of our government and the burden of overregulation. As recommended by the county comprehensive plan, the county has taken steps to review all of its regulations, not just the building code enforcement. To review the development code, the county has hired Ducker & Associates and appointed a 16-member steering committee. This process is ongoing and has already had several meetings and public hearings with four goals in mind: implement the comprehensive plan, increase economic development opportunity, protect private property rights, and protect the environment. Increasing economic development is crucial in Mille Lacs County. We hope to be more encouraging and supportive of our citizens and businesses to expand and improve properties. We are trying to encourage new businesses as well. The lessening of regulations comes to the citizens in many forms. It can come in allowing more standard land uses, which we're currently working on. It can also be allowing more options for individual septic systems, which we're currently working on with Minnesota Pollution Control. More wetland mitigation options, and opting out of building code enforcement. The citizens always favor local control, and I can tell you that during my campaign for county commissioner, the number one concern folks had was too much regulation, followed by taxation. I'm asking for your support on this bill today on behalf of the citizens of Mille Lacs County. Please pass this bill and support removal of the enforcement of the Minnesota Building Code for Mille Lacs County.
Thank you, Commissioner Oslin. If you want to identify yourself for the record, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michelle McPherson. I'm the director of the Land Services Office on behalf of Mille Lacs County. My role in that position is to actually oversee the administration of all of the county's various land use ordinances, as well as the state building code administration and enforcement on the local level. I also concurrently wear the hat of the county recorder and registrar of titles. Just a brief history regarding adoption of the local enforcement administration of the state building code in Mille Lacs County. We adopted our local enforcement and administration program in 2003. At that time, the statute did allow jurisdictions who chose to adopt the state building code local enforcement administration to rescind that adoption essentially at any time. And I don't have all the details as to how that process worked, but there was an option to that jurisdictions could consider rescinding their adoption. In 2008, the legislature adopted a statute which made the state building code essentially the code of the land for the state of Minnesota, and the state building code, which is administered by the Department of Labor and Industry, superseded all other municipal codes that may have been in place at the same time. So the intent of that statute was to essentially create an even playing field for all contractors within the state of Minnesota. However, at that same time, there was a provision in that statute which essentially prohibited and removed local control for jurisdictions who had chosen to adopt the building code and had the local enforcement and administration programs in place at that time. That was done without comment, giving local partners who were administering local state building code at the local level an opportunity to comment. In fact, it was not until we, again, through a citizens group, were looking at regulation in the county prior to the beginning of our comprehensive plan process, it was unbeknownst to us until that time that this provision had been put in place by the legislature. So to say the least, we were rather dismayed that one of our options for local control had been removed from us. I want to make it clear to the committee that the residents of Mille Lacs County understand that the state building code is the law of the land for construction. It is a minimum standard, and we're not looking to opt out of the building code itself. What we are looking for is essentially authority approval to give us back our option to rescind local administration and enforcement. The state of Minnesota, through the Department of Labor and Industry, is responsible for the training and licensing of contractors of any number of types, including roofing contractors, building contractors, etc. There is an implied contract between that licensure and the requirement that those contractors build to the state minimum requirements. By allowing us to rescind our local enforcement and administration of the state building code, you are essentially allowing consumers to choose whether or not they want an independent third-party inspector to essentially ensure that the contractors are meeting the obligation of their implied contract with the state of Minnesota through their licensure. This is a consumer choice as opposed to a state mandate. So again, by supporting this bill, you are returning, at least to Mille Lacs County, local control and flexibility, returning choice to local constituents and consumers. And as Commissioner Oslin pointed out, there are a number of counties, at least to the north, east, and west of us, who do not have not adopted local administration and enforcement. And as such, we have a bit of a competitive disadvantage in terms of the marketplace. So with that, I'm requesting, again, along with Commissioner Oslin, your support of this bill.
Thank you, Ms. McPherson. I know Representative Dean has a question. Other questions, members? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Testifiers. You're going to have to help me out a little bit here. I'm hearing you say that it would allow individuals the opportunity to bring in a third-party inspector to inspect the work of the contractor. And if that's the case, what is the licensing or process by which a third-party inspector develops their credentials? As I just think of this right off the top of my head, I become a little bit concerned because building codes aren't necessarily in place for the person at the time of the construction of that project. Oftentimes, building codes have things in place to protect the future buyer or protect the future user of the project, because once you encapsulate many of the things in buildings, there's no way to verify whether or not they were to meet the particular code when someone purchases that project, short of taking off all the sheetrock, verifying the resizing of all the beams and all those other things. So I guess my question directly is there a third-party process by which these third-party inspectors receive their credentials through approval from the state regarding the current state building codes?
Mr. Chair, Actually, the Department of Labor Industry, in addition to training and certifying contractors as required, they also train and certify residential and commercial and chief building officials. And our current chief building official does offer his services at the private sector level, and he is certified as a chief building official by the state of Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. So there is a set of credentials and criteria by which all residential and commercial industrial inspectors are trained and certified to.
Thank you, Ms. McPherson. Representative Dean.
So just so I follow you, you currently have a building inspector in the city, and you want to, or in the county, and you want to take that responsibility that you currently have at the county level and state that it can now be through a third-party inspector, allowing the consumer to choose to actually hire your building inspector privately to come in and do the inspection. Did I follow that correctly?
Ms. McPherson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Currently, by the adoption of the state building code, we are mandated to have a chief building official as part of the program. So, and of course, as part of the local administration and enforcement, there are certain requirements for permits and inspections that are set forth by the state building code. As opposed to hiring a full-time staff member, we do have a chief building official that we have contracted with in order to meet our statutory mandate under the state building code, local enforcement and administration. For an example, if within the county, we have a number of jurisdictions that do not enforce the state building code because they are small and they have chosen not to adopt the state building code. So if you go to the city of Onamia, which is within our jurisdiction, a contractor building a new house or re-roofing a structure, there is no oversight. There is no one who is following behind, whereas in the county we're mandated to have an inspection for a roofer. Essentially what we're asking for is to turn back the clock and go back to the way it was in 2003, at which point the state building code was in place. There was just no one following behind the contractors to ensure that, in fact, those construction standards were met. In this case, if we were given the opportunity to rescind the local administration enforcement, contractors would be obligated to basically comply with the statute without county-mandated oversight. And a homeowner could choose to either trust their contractor, which happens in 76% of the counties in the state of Minnesota, or they could choose to hire any number of chief building officials that may be available for service at a fee.
Thank you, Ms. McPherson. Representative Deedgood. Members, other questions? Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the good people of Mille Lacs County. I was just wondering if there's been any thought given to the insurance rates for properties that have been constructed and inspected in a different way other than typically have been done. I know when a certificate of occupancy is issued for a commercial building, you know, they'll take a look at all the construction techniques and inspection records as well, but I'm just wondering if we're setting up the homeowners and business owners for some higher insurance rates if they're not complying with the standard procedures given throughout the state.
Thank you, Representative Sunine. Ms. McPherson.
Mr. Chair, I can actually respond to that. We actually did have the ISO meet with our chief building official. They meet with our chief building official roughly every 3 to 4 years, and while we go through an extensive review of the program, there really is no benefit based on the current program to residents and as to their insurance rates. So it's actually a very frustrating process for our chief building official because there's no net positive or negative result to county resident insurance rates.
Thank you, Ms. McPherson. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned the homeowners, how about business owners that are those businesses that are inspected there as far as a fire danger, let's say in a motel or a restaurant?
Ms. McPherson.
Mr. Chair, there are certain parts of the state building code that will be inspected regardless of whether we continue to have a local administration enforcement program. Things such as fire inspections, plumbing inspections for hotels, motels, etc. There are many inspections that are actually covered by state agencies that would take care of those public health and safety issues in terms of businesses.
Representative Sandy.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're saying that most of the commercial properties would be in pretty good shape, regardless of any changes. So how many building permits are issued in Mille Lacs County for residential improvements and construction? And, you know, how big of a problem are you putting before us here?
Mr. Chair, in 2014, our permit load was approximately 400 permits. Of that, I would say approximately 50% were for normal maintenance things, siding replacement, window replacement, roof replacement. We do a number of agricultural buildings or garages. I would say of those remaining percentage of new construction for new homes would be roughly 20% at this point. We're still seeing a somewhat depressed economy due to the market.
Thank you, Ms. McPherson. Good. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming Ms. McPherson, you'll answer this. So that's the number of permits that were actually pulled for the work. Do you have any type of crews that go out and look for work that's being done where no one's pulled a permit? And if so, how many occurrences annually do you run across projects where people are building without a permit?
Mr. Chair, thank you. The county board's current policy is that we do not do enforcement by seeking out issues. However, the chief building official, if he sees a licensed contractor working and he does not have a permit, he will work through the state of Minnesota in regards to that contractor, because that would be a breach of that implied contract. But the county board's direction to staff is that we do not seek out illegal activities of any nature, whether it's a zoning violation or a building violation. But we would take complaints about folks who are building without permits. I would say, in general, we see 10 to 15 permits or complaints of that nature on an annual basis.
Representative Dean, you're good? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I was holding up this map earlier, but 47 counties in our state have local control. No. And, excuse me? Yes. No. All of the white. Minnesota Building Code is the standard. However, the code is enforced by cities and townships and within a county. So just so you know, the law that was passed in 2009 did have an effect on those who had agreed earlier.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to come down and speak in favor or against this bill? Seeing no one. Any other questions from members? Seeing none. With that, Representative Erickson, we'll give you the final word.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I know how strongly we believe in local control, and I think in a county like Mille Lacs, it is essential, based on the plan that we went through for 3 years, and the people spoke to us. I participated at a great length in the discussions and served on an ad hoc committee as well, that they want to have control. They want the county to be in charge of the enforcement. And so I hope that you can agree that we can pass this bill on with that in mind. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Erickson, and we're not going to pass your bill today.
No, I said pass it on.
No, we're not going to pass it on. Okay. We're going to re-refer
it. I'm sorry. I hope you'll re-refer it.
With that, Representative Swedzinski renews his motion that House File 1026 be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs and Energy Finance. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
Aye.
Motion prevails, and
thank
the
you,
measure is on its way. Thank you both to both of the testifiers. You did a nice job. Thank you, Representative Erickson.
Thank you.
Okay. Good idea. Okay. Not seeing Representative Dill. We'll go ahead. Representative Tice, do you want to come up, and we'll go ahead and do with your bill? While she's on her way up, Representative Applebaum, would you like to move the minutes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that the minutes from our meeting on March 4th, 2015 be adopted.
Thank you for that. I appreciate it. Members, any questions about the minutes from that day, comments, concerns? Seeing none, the minutes, we should probably vote on that. All those in favor of the Applebaum motion to approve the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Applebaum and members. With that, Representative Tice, would you like to go ahead and move House File 539 and then proceed?
I would love to move it. There is also an A15-0150. I would like to, that amendment I would like to go through first.
Okay. An author's amendment. Representative Tice has moved the House File 539 and would like to move the amendment. Those in favor of the A15-0150 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. The bill is now in the shape the author would like it to be in. With that, Representative Tice, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I've been told to be very brief, so basically
thank you, Representative Tice. Would you like to introduce your testifiers?
I would.
Go ahead.
I would actually turn it over to Ms. Stone, and she can put her 2 cents worth in quickly.
Quickly. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Remy Stone. I represent the Builders Association of Minnesota. In a nutshell, what we have done with this delete all amendment is effectively create a six-year code cycle. It says five in your amendment, but that's put in there so that we can accommodate any delays that happen with the six-year cycle so that we don't miss the ICC model codes as they come out every 3 to 6. They come out every 3 years, but we want to fix ourselves to the second of those three-year cycles for six. So that's the first part of the bill. Second part of this amended bill is that we have an extended implementation time frame. This is very important. I have one little visual aid here. This book. We love this book. It was something that the Department of Labor and Industry did not need to do. It's something that they did to help the industry and the enforcement community to learn this new code. But every 6 years, we have the pleasure of learning, and we have had this pleasure since 2000. We've had the pleasure of learning a 575-page new code. And what we learned this year is that not only did it take the agency almost 5-6 months to put this book together, it also took us as an association 6 months to put our cliff notes together for this book. This bill, as amended, provides for a 9-month horizon, and it also does another thing that is incredibly important. One of the challenges that we have with this last code cycle is that we were not able to see the full code online in its final version prior to the effective date. And that's why it took the agency a long time to get this out. It's one of the reasons why it took us a long time to make our cliff notes available. And we believe that for that portion of this amendment, we've reached a consensus with the Department of Labor and Industry and other folks. So those are the three elements to it. The other thing that I want to point out in the amendment that you have, we are making sure that in the middle of that six-year code cycle, the Department of Labor and Industry maintains its authority to do mid-cycle amendments for life, for safety, for efficiency, for building materials, for technology. Nothing in this amendment is intended to upset federal law. Right now, federal law requires the Department of Labor and Industry, for example, to look at the energy code and write back to the feds as to whether or not they will be doing an update to that code. Nothing in this amendment upends that ability. And with that, I'd like you to hear from a real builder who actually tells us that they need this stuff.
Thank you, Ms. Stone. Mr. Schoenberg, please identify yourself for the record and proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Craig Schoenberg. My company, Schoenberg Construction, was started by my dad, Jerry Schoenberg, and the company has celebrated their 41 years this past January. Personally, I have 24 years' experience in the construction industry. We primarily perform residential home remodeling, custom new home construction, some light commercial. I am the current 2015 Central Minnesota Builders Association president, and I've been a CMBA, our company has been a CMBA member for 41 years. Thank you for listening today. I do appreciate the opportunity to speak. My position, that the 3 years is a short time frame for a complete code update. 6 years is a preferred code cycle with mid-cycle code amendments. The three-year code cycle makes it very challenging for everyone in the industry to get up to date, including builders, subcontractors, and inspectors. And I would say a new code takes a good year to fully learn it and know it and enforce it. I am hearing some inspectors are frustrated these days enforcing the code when they're still learning the code and simply not educated and prepared to enforce it, and many builders are frustrated as well. One other item to note, the current Minnesota 2015 Energy Code book is out of stock as of today. I checked this morning. How can we build in the new code when I will even gain access to that code book? Apparently it's back ordered, should be available early April, I believe. So with that, we are in favor of the House File 539 and improving our industry. I ask for your support on Representative Tice's.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenberg and Ms. Stone. And I have a question. So with the amendment that we just adopted, the A15 amendment, what does that do to fire sprinklers?
Nothing.
Okay, so that's not going to change the implementation date on that?
No. Nope.
Okay, and so that's a change from the bill as it was currently written?
Correct.
With regards to that and to some of the other issues that are in this bill, I want to thank you, Representative Tice, and both of you and everybody else here that's been working on this. It is a work in progress, and as you know, in the Commerce Committee, we love peace in the valley, and I understand we might not have 100% peace, but I also understand we're getting pretty close, so thank you for that. Members, any questions? Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schoenberger, I think it was?
Schoenberg,
okay. Yep. Thanks for coming today, but I was just wondering, on the three-year cycle of renewal of codes, you've experienced 8 of them so far. How many times have you been found in violation of any building codes?
Mr. Schoenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In violation?
So
never, unless there's some final items.
Okay. My point being, after 8 cycles, you've been able to comply quite nicely, and I thank you for that.
Thank you, Representative Sundin. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Tice for the testifier. So when the new IBC, IRC, or ICC is issued, there's usually quite a long period of time which takes place where comments are made by the building community as well as other folks. And sometimes it can take 2 to 3 years before we actually adopt a code. From previously, if I'm not mistaken, was it 2003, wasn't adopted till 2007, or it might have been 6. So how is this either working in concert with a process that generally takes quite a long time, or how is this working sort of to delay a process which might be in place? If you could just comment on that.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, you are absolutely right. So what has happened since 2000? We have adopted a code in 2000, 2006, 2012, right? The 2012 is now called the 2015, and we're on Minnesota's 2015 code. We are now looking at the 2018 code, and we fully expect that will be the next I code that we will pick up. This bill itself only deals with the IBC, the International Building Code, and the International Residential Code. We have gone through probably 5 iterations on trying to figure out how to pin this to a 2018 code, and then every 6 years from that. And that's one of the cumbersome pieces that we've had in trying to draft this appropriately. One of the things we've also heard is that if we get behind on the 2018, we could potentially be looking at an effective date of 2021. And if we're at a 2021 effective date, I'm so sorry to do this to you. I'm not good at math, but I'm learning how to add by 6. If we get to an effective date of 2021, that we could be looking at the 2027 code, which is not the goal of this legislation. What this legislation is trying to do is codify a process that's been in place since 2000 that is part of a current letter from the Department of Labor and Industry establishing that. And the reason why we need that, and Mr. Schoenberg could speak to it even in more detail, but certainty in this industry is so incredibly important. Not only is it important for us to have that learning curve and build to a code that's relatively stable for a few years, but for our partners on the backside, for example, our insurance companies, they really rely on knowing that the code that we're building to is building durable houses that aren't having major defects, water intrusion, structural. And so we're trying to fix in statute some certainty for those backside partners of ours.
Thank you, Ms. Stone. Representative Dean, does that answer your question?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think sort of we're saying that it takes 5-6 years anyways right now in the process that we're going through. As someone who's had to learn the code backwards and forward as an architect, it's, you know, if the builders build to what we're drawing, ultimately we're the ones responsible, not the builder. But it's good to know that we have other checks and other builders out there that, as I say, may not know everything in the code book, but they know they're responsible for what's in the code book. And so I'll end with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Other questions, members? I know we have a couple of other testifiers, and I don't remember names. Allison Lindberg and Sherry Brzezinka. Please, as you come on down, identify yourselves for the record and start whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
My name and by the way, welcome to the committee. Sorry, I forgot that.
Thank you. My name is Allison Lindberg, and I am with Fresh Energy. We're a nonprofit organization, and we work on energy efficiency and clean energy policy. And for the last 3.5 years, I have actually been working with the Department of Labor and Industry and other stakeholders on the adoption of the Residential and Commercial Energy Code. And energy codes are a really important part of our energy conservation strategy because buildings account for 40% of our energy consumption in the United States. So I'm here today to express my concerns about the bill. As Representative Hoppe mentioned, we have been working to reach some consensus, but we're not quite there yet. But I think that you should hear what we have some concerns about. So our concerns are basically with the minimum 6-year cycle. And that also that provision that relates to the amended possibility for amendment in the interim. So just to give you guys a little bit of background, the energy codes are updated nationally every 3 years, introducing new energy efficiency technology at an appropriate pace. So whenever we skip an update, as we just recently did, it requires builders to learn a much larger update with a higher learning curve and potentially higher costs, rather than simply picking up the incremental changes as they occur. So a minimum cycle of every 6 years or 5 years puts Minnesota builders in a place of uncertainty because it actually doesn't provide a specific timeline for when the next code adoption cycle is going to happen. Energy efficiency translates into cost savings for home and building owners. And because of our harsh weather, Minnesotans believe that we're building to the most energy efficient standards that we can have in the nation, which is just not true. As it's been mentioned, we are currently one cycle behind in the IECC, which stands for the International Energy Conservation Code. So in February, we adopted we started enforcing the residential one, which is the IECC 2012, and we didn't even adopt the full one. We are actually, it's a version that's 10% less energy efficient than the full IECC 2012. And we're already in 2015, and we have no intentions of adopting the 2015. As also what has been mentioned here is that the code adoption cycle takes usually between 2 to 3 years. So one of our concerns with this bill, and we hope to get this worked out, is how do we ensure that that's not actually a 9-year adoption cycle and that we're adopting codes on a 9-year path. A 6-year cycle guarantees that we will not be up to date with energy codes because we're not adopting them on a 3-year cycle, and we're just suggesting that we leave that option open. A minimum cycle suggests we may actually never adopt a new code, and neighboring states, Illinois and Iowa, are already on their way to adopting the IECC 2015, so we're already behind. So this also harms the state of Minnesota. In 2007, the Minnesota legislature set statewide emission reduction goals with broad bipartisan support and restricting the ability to choose to adopt up-to-date energy codes makes it more difficult for the state to reach these goals. It also puts Minnesota behind other states that are leading in energy efficiency. So for these reasons, we urge you to not place restrictions on adopting up-to-date energy codes. And thank you so much for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Lindberg. Mm-hmm. Ms. Brzezinka, if you want to come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sherry Brzezinka, I'm the Executive Director of the U.S. Green Building Council here in
Minnesota.
Welcome
to the committee.
The U.S. Green Building Council is a 501c3 nonprofit organization that's been working for the past 10 years here in Minnesota to transform the way that we design, build, maintain, and operate our buildings, our homes, and our communities. We have 400 individual members who include builders, residential builders, designers, general contractors, engineers, operators, owners, and property managers. And there are also 250 Minnesota-based businesses who are USGBC members here in Minnesota. USGBC supports policies, practices, and innovations that make Minnesota a leader in energy-efficient buildings, including adopting the most up-to-date model energy codes. Increasing energy efficiency in buildings is something that affects the occupants, we feel, as much or if not more than the builders. As Allison mentioned, Minnesota homeowners and commercial building owners are relying on good construction techniques to ensure that their energy bills remain low over the duration of their ownership. And they expect Minnesota builders to construct buildings that are energy efficient. Minnesota was recently ranked number 10 in the nation for LEED certified commercial buildings. This is a voluntary green building rating system, and this leads to the perception that in Minnesota, we are among the most energy efficient states when it comes to buildings, which may not be the case. While voluntary green building systems such as LEED have been designed to benchmark beyond code leadership for buildings that intend to go above the bare minimums, it's equally important that this leadership is complemented with comprehensive and up-to-date building codes that can raise the floor for the entire community and not just voluntary leaders. Our residential buildings in Minnesota are falling behind, as Allison mentioned, the commercial buildings, and the residential energy code that was just adopted is 10% less efficient than the IEC 2012, which is now already a three-year-old code. This puts Minnesota in a position to become even further behind in our region. As Allison mentioned, neighboring states like Illinois and Iowa have already adopted the IEC 2012 and are on their way to adopting 2015. So this bill creates uncertainty in Minnesota that codes can be adopted in a timely fashion. We feel very concerned that a six-year code cycle with the additional implementation time is going to put Minnesota in a dangerous position to fall behind in the latest evolutions in building science, technology, and practice. So USGBC also urges that you would remove the energy codes from this bill. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Brzezinka. Questions, members? Not, I think we have Ms. Oh, sorry, Representative Scott, my apologies.
Oh, that's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know which person this would be for, maybe either one of you, but are you finding from an energy perspective that the consumers are asking for higher efficiency, higher energy efficient homes in the state of Minnesota?
Anybody that wants to take that? Ms. Brzezinka?
Mr. Chair, yes, I can say from experience of our members and our community that most definitely both residential and commercial businesses are looking for energy efficiency. Not only does it create, help us save energy in our state, but drastically reduces their energy bills and helps them to be able to afford, especially residential, the cost of their homes over time.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you for that answer. Well, wouldn't you think then that just that demand alone would cause builders to want to build more energy efficient homes so that they can meet the demand of their customers? And if they aren't doing that, do you suppose that, why do you suppose that might be?
Whoever wants to take it, go ahead, jump right in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Scott. I can only guess. Maybe we should ask a builder, but I would suggest that there might be a lack of education on beyond code energy efficiency practices to be able to meet that demand. That would be a suggestion for me. And I would also say that I know that Habitat for Humanity of Minnesota is currently building beyond our new energy code because they do see such a reduction in their energy bills. So they're training people that are not actually builders that come there on site, and they are able to show them that they can build energy efficiently.
Thank you, Ms. Lindbergh. Mm-hmm. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm just wondering if cost doesn't have something to do with this, but I don't know if Representative Tice, your family's been in the building construction business, and I know your other testifier has. I don't know if all this energy efficiency and these certifications and so forth, it looks like Minnesota's, I mean, we're already 10th in the nation. That seems to be pretty good to me. But any ideas on what that's done to affect the cost or the price of the house?
Representative Tice, do you want to take that one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Scott. You know, it does add cost, but having been in the industry for 29 years, and in fact, I bet a lot of you don't know that I was the 2007 Central Minnesota Builders Association president.
Uh-huh.
So I've been around this for quite a while. And it totally drives what our projects are. A lot of our projects and being in the remodeling industry, we saw a lot of it was just upping the energy efficiency in the home. So most people think, you know, windows, insulation, doors, but there's other things you can do as well. So it kind of surprised me when I heard some of the comments because it's driven our industry for years. It is not a new deal, and Minnesota has been leading energy efficiency for many years, and that won't change. Again, I will point out that this bill preserves the ability for the commissioner to conduct mid-cycle code amendments as warranted and necessary to serve the public's interest. That says that if there is a three-year energy code update, they certainly can do it. It does not rule it out. But Minnesota does not always adopt that. So, you know, I just can't say enough. Minnesota has always been doing such a great job. And that was the bulk of our projects, was just doing energy efficiency, including things. And a lot of times when we went into other projects, we would talk about what they can do to increase the efficiency. So up front, yes, but there's many options as far as window types. I mean, there are tons of different windows to pick from. And it was up to you what you wanted, good, better, best. And we always would do the best that we could with what their budget allowed for. So, yes, we've been doing this for years and years.
Thank you.
Representative Dean, you have a question to this point? Otherwise, Ms. Frenette wants to come down and...
Yeah, I actually do have a question to this point. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Tice, you just said that there's nothing that prohibits the commissioner from every 3 years instituting the new IECC as part of the state building code.
Representative Tice.
Mr. Chair, Representative D. No, they absolutely have the right to conduct mid-cycle amendments. And if Minnesota chooses to adopt at that time the energy code, they certainly may do so.
Ms. Frenette, you want to come down and speak to this issue? Thank you to both of you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Frenette, and I represent the American Chemistry Council on this bill. We look forward to working with the coalition that has been working on this bill to address a couple of issues. The first would be the six-year code cycle and how it's going to be implemented in the interim with Minnesota amendments that possibly need to come down, in particular with the energy code right now under 42 U.S.C. 6833, which is a federal Department of Energy law. The state is required to review the codes every 3 years and then decide whether or not they would like to apply the codes to Minnesota. I spoke with the Department of Labor and Industry back some time ago, and they said they had opted out of it this last July, which is what they decided to do, and we again look forward to working with the coalition on making this a better bill.
Thank you, Ms. Burnett. I appreciate everybody willing to work on this issue and keep working on it as it moves forward. Anybody else in the audience want to come down and speak for or against the bill? Yes, sir. Come on up. go ahead, please grab a seat and identify yourself and start whenever you're ready.
Okay, my name is Jim Fallon. I'm here with the carpenters today, and I have a background in building codes. I was the state plans examiner for the last 22 years. I was also the foreman on this building in 1984.
I have some questions for you.
Good.
No, I'm kidding.
I've got answers for you.
I'm sorry. Please
proceed. The building code started in 1972, 1973. Mm-hmm. It has always gone on a three-year cycle. They always give it a 1 year after it was, you know, published. They skipped it in 1991. It was a mistake. They just missed it. It caused so much trouble because when 94 got adopted, everybody missed that elevator lobbies had to be enclosed because there's always a little bar saying this is a change. Wasn't there. Everybody wanted to know, how come we missed it? Well, because they adopted one and it wasn't a change to 91, which we didn't adopt. That caused havoc with the designers, the architectural firms, the inspectors, everybody. So the state said, well, we're not going to do that again. And then lo and behold, they did in 2003 with the international code. So I would speak against anything. Always go with the three-year cycle, the 1 year, and try to stay up to date. And it's the same thing for the builders. They don't change the code that much. They change little things that really cost you a lot of money if you miss them. That's the gist of that. And I didn't bring you a gift because, you know, it's...
You're not required to,
Mr. $4.99, I didn't salt you, you know.
No worries. I appreciate it. Members, okay. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Okay.
Anybody else want to speak for or against the bill? Seeing no one else, with that, Representative Tice will give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Being in the industry, I know that code changes are expensive, and they take a lot of time to get everybody up to date. Having a six-year cycle also gives us the opportunity to look at how some of the code implements in real life. A lot of times they're good theory, but when you put them out there, they really aren't. They can cause some additional problems. So I think this is a great opportunity to take care of these and to make it a little bit more builder-friendly. With that, I would appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tice. Representative Tice renews her motion that House File 539 be re-referred, 539 as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs and Energy Finance. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
Aye. No.
Motion prevails. 539 is on its way to Jobs and Energy Finance. Thank you to all the testifiers for and against. Thank you, Representative Tice. Representative Dill, come on down. I will move House File 1014. Representative Dill, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you for moving House File 1014. The bill comes to me from a constituent who is a retailer. Let me give you a very, very quick rundown of what is happening. In 340A, 318, it allows for liquor, meaning I call it hard liquor, booze, to be delivered with a 30-day credit extension to the retailer. In the case of beer, under 340A, 308, it does not allow for that provision to have any, in other words, it's COD on delivery at each location. This all came from prohibition when retailer or when brewers were selling and branding with retailers, and they would have a bit of a monopoly or financial connections to each other, and they could move things around a bit. As you can imagine, back in those days of Al Capone, things happened like that. So then became the three-tier system, where you had a distiller, a distributor, and a retailer. And that worked very well for, and still is in existence to this day, for that group of folks that sell beer. However, in the case of beer, there is no extension of credit specifically because of that original relationship we talked about a long time ago. The bill allows for a 30-day of extension of credit for deliveries of beer, as well as another provision, like I call it a circuit breaker, or until the next delivery is made. So if a retailer took delivery each week, he would have to make sure that the beer he got the previous week was paid for. Now, I bring this all before you today so that you just, if you haven't already, have a kind of a basic understanding of how those systems work, alcohol versus beer. Luckily, Mr. Chairman, we've been able in the room to make some arrangements within these groups of folks and constituents that it appears that if you lay the bill over on the table, we would take no further action on the bill. However, if you lay it on the table and we aren't able to effectuate the agreements that have been made in the last few moments, we might have a different feeling about that. So with that, I'll stand for questions.
Representative Dill, well said. Members, any questions for Representative Dill? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dill. So is there anything that prohibits interest being charged, or is it up to the distributor if they're charging interest for the particular retailer?
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Dean. In the language that I have before you as proposed right now, it would only allow the 30-day extension of credit. There may be something in other statutes that would allow interest to be charged, but nothing that I would propose to be changed in this bill would do any more than allow for the 30-day extension of credit, which the current law does not allow, plus the circuit breaker, as I explained it, meaning if you were a small resort and you took deliveries once a month, you would essentially have, assuming you were qualified for credit. Now, if you didn't qualify for credit, which would be the responsibility of the distributor to determine, you would pay every 30 days. But if you had a store that sold beer every week and you had to replace it each week, you would be paying before the next invoice. And frankly, members, there are problems that this bill would create if it were done, and that's the reason that we reached the tentative agreement.
Is there anybody in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? Seeing no one, Representative Dill, we always appreciate authors that are working with the other parties in trying to come to a conclusion. And with that, I won't renew my motion. We'll just lay House File over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Liquor Bill. House File 1014.
Thank you very much, Chair Hoppe.
Thank you very much, Representative Dill. Nice work. Representative Sanders, are you ready to go next?
Let's do it.
Representative Sanders will move House File 864. excuse me. We'll recommend that House File 864 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Representative Sanders?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've hit quite a law here, so I thought we'd liven things up and talk insurance for a while.
And Representative Sanders, you have the DE1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
You want to go ahead and move that amendment to get the shape, the bill in the shape that you would like it to be in?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So moved.
Representative Sanders moves the DE1 amendment. Has everybody seen that? All those in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Representative Sanders, please proceed and tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The DE1 represents, a pretty big compromise on this language across several different groups. We have here in Minnesota, as you all know, the no-fault system here, which is great and very consumer-oriented, but also lends itself quite easily to insurance fraud. And this bill that you have in front of you, House File 864, is an anti-fraud bill, auto insurance fraud bill. And while we realize that we will never be able to stop fraud completely in its tracks on the outset, this bill will quite a ways in really slowing down auto insurance fraud that is currently happening in Minnesota. Minnesota is ranks as one of the highest states when it comes to insurance fraud, and so we really want to curtail that and get this under control and right-size consumers' protection as well as their premiums. So with that, I want to congratulate and thank all of the folks that have worked on this bill across the different groups, in particular Mr. Franzen, as well. But at this time, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to him to kind of walk through the bill. And I'll just say on the outset, all the provisions in this bill really have already been enacted in other states and work well. So nothing entirely new in this bill, but we are putting them together here in Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. And this question is either for you or Mr. Franzen or whomever. Do the changes that we just made to this bill and the DE amendment reflect ongoing work in the Senate as well? Are we on a parallel path with our friends in the Senate? Mr. Franzen.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Doug Franzen. I'm here on behalf of the National Insurance Crime Bureau. In response to your question, yes, the conversations have been going on for some time, and the language you have before you in the DE one amendment was enacted, was passed by the Senate Commerce Committee yesterday. It has been slightly clarified and improved by House Research, but with the consent of everybody involved.
Mr. Franzen, we find that frequently things from the Senate can be approved by House Research.
Amen, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, the bill has three sections. They're fairly straightforward. Section 1 and 2 represents an agreement between our group, the Insurance Federation, and the Minnesota Chiropractic Association. And I believe Mr. Good knows in the audience, and he said, you know, it was fine that I would make that representation on his behalf, and if he has a problem, I'm sure he will stand up and correct me. But it is. Section 1 is fairly simple. It gives the Commerce Department an ability to fine intentional wrongdoing through fraud. The people who intentionally commit fraud can be fined by the Commerce Department. The maximum is a $20,000 fine per occurrence. The minimum, I believe, is $1,000. Restitution to the injured victim, which would include not only the insurer, but the actual consumer, may be ordered by the Commerce Department as well. The fine may be contested through the administrative process. The due process provisions are contained within Section 1, and you know, as if there are questions as we go on. Section 2 is simple. If you have been convicted in a court of law for insurance fraud, for no-fault insurance fraud, you are essentially contracts for payment for no-fault services are not enforceable. What that means is you can continue to provide the services as a convicted felon to accident victims, but simply they don't have to pay you. And they're insured. It's a self-help remedy. They can pay if they want to, but under the law, you can't enforce that contract. I'm sorry, in Section 1 and 2, I would be remiss if I say the Commerce Department is here and they also support the provisions. It's also supported, the entire bill is also supported by a number of prosecutors, including Ramsey County, Washington County, Anoka County, and Dakota County prosecutors. Number 3 Section number 3 is a work product between the Insurance Federation and the Minnesota Newspaper Association that had concerns with the original language. And simply what it says is you can't take public lists of accident victims and mail out solicitations, marketing materials to them. We have examples where they sometimes can be outrageous at best, and we believe that will certainly stem the growing tide of these insurance schemes that Mr. Lynch will describe how they work. He will use words like organized crime. So I would say that also on Section 3, I'm not sure the Minnesota Association for Justice is quite there yet. So you may hear from them today. We're continuing to talk, of course. But that's the bill. It's pretty straightforward. We believe it's modest in scope, but can give the state important tools to combat the rising insurance fraud in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Franzen. Mr. Lynch?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tim Lynch. I'm the Director of Government Affairs at the National Insurance Crime Bureau based in Chicago, Illinois. The NICB is a national not-for-profit organization that works with our member companies along with law enforcement, to investigate major cases of insurance fraud, namely organized crime. We're active not only here in Minnesota, but in every state across the country. In short, we strongly support this bill. Tony Palumbo, the Anoka County attorney, said it best. What's insurance fraud? He answered it with a simple answer of this. Insurance fraud is bad things being done by bad people to very good people. And that's essentially what this bill is trying to protect. Trying to fix. This bill is important for three very specific reasons from the NICB vantage point. We are the repository for questionable claim activity from our member companies. And Minnesota has three main problems that we've identified. Number one, other states such as Florida and New York have made some major anti-fraud crackdowns due to rises in organized crime. And we're seeing linkages here in Minnesota to those very groups. They're setting up camp here due to a less restrictive environment. Number two, these groups are organized criminals. They're professionals. They do this for a living. And they're victimizing many of your citizens. Thirdly, this crime is costing Minnesotans $1,400 a year, according to many estimates. And those estimates range from $30 billion nationally to $1,000. But the bottom line is costing you money. There are random, very specific cases of victimization of immigrant populations and senior citizens. Insurance fraud is low risk for a very high reward. And as Doug mentioned, many other states have enacted these laws. We've seen some modest successes from those states. No declarations of victory, but modest successes. They are common sense. They're welcomed by law enforcement. Your state has been granted the authority to investigate insurance fraud, and that's great. Some states don't even have that. So on that line alone, you're to be congratulated. But to do it effectively, it needs the right tools in the toolbox. And this bill does exactly that. I also want to mention this bill is supported by the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud based in Washington, D.C. This is a group comprised of the nation's leading consumer groups as well as insurers, and they strongly support this bill. So we strongly support 864. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Lynch. Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to come down and speak briefly for or against this bill? Mr. Johnson, welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you. Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I won't repeat, Mr. Chairman and committee members, but thank you and Representative Sanders for joining the fight that we need to engage in the state in terms of combating the negative impact on Minnesota consumers statewide on this crime of insurance fraud. The list of who's a part of this effort, Mr. Lynch mentioned that, but you don't have a letter just because of the timing here, but Ramsey County Attorney John Choi supports us. There is a long list of public-private players that are coming together. The Coalition Against Insurance Fraud, as Mr. Lynch mentioned, some of you may remember Howard Goldblatt is the gentleman that comes. He was not able to be here today. He did testify in the Senate. And to really look at that organization to see who comprises the board of directors of the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud, because it is a very broad cross-section of private groups, public groups, more consumer groups than you'll hear from at any time are part of the board, including groups that frankly you normally don't see kind of banding together the way they have banded together on this fight. Groups like the Consumer Federation of America, the Consumer Action, Consumer Alliance, the Citizens Advocacy Center, and many others. So I just note, Mr. Chairman, because it is important to see how this diverse coalition of public and private players who disagree on a number of other issues don't disagree, that this is a fight we have to do. And nobody defends fraud, I know that, and they shouldn't and wouldn't. But it's not easy to get at it. And the statistics were given, this is a significant negative impact, pocketbook impact on Minnesota consumers, and the Insurance Research Council, just to mention that, it's a statistical data gathering organization, and they recently did a 35,000 auto injury closed claim study to quantify what's going on with the auto insurance fraud. And unfortunately, Minnesota was in the top three states countrywide on the percentage of cases where there's fraud and fraud buildup. So that's from a nationwide basis. But I think some folks challenge whether or not this is a real issue and is it really happening in Minnesota and there are really dollars that are being paid out. And the answer is yes, there's significant dollars. A letter that I have here that I don't have distributed to you all, but I'll just read you a sentence out of it. It's out of a administrative law judge public record from just a couple of months ago, this past summer, where a local attorney identified a staged accident, auto accident ring that he's directly working on representing multiple no-fault insurers. They've obtained multiple confessions from participants who have testified that the ring has staged a minimum of 300 to 500 accidents in Minnesota involving 4,000 no-fault claims with in excess of $50 million in no-fault benefits. And these are cases where there's sworn statement confessions. He wasn't able to produce them because they're still part of an ongoing criminal investigation. So I just mention it in case there's some question. Is this a real deal? Is it really affecting Minnesotans? And then are those costs coming together? So, Mr. Chairman, there's other information. I know Mr. Franzen has gone through the bill. It's a real problem. It's a real issue. It's affecting us. We have a diverse partner array of players who are coming together. We got to be smart on this battle. The fraudsters are really smart. And as states deal with it, there is a migration that's going on from some of the East Coast states to this state. And if we don't stay ahead of it, we're going to continue to lose, and the fraudsters are going to gain, and the dollar amounts are going to go up, and consumers are going to pay the price for that. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I just urge your support for the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Abler or Mr. Carlson, whoever wants to come up next. Please proceed whenever you're ready. Identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be here. This is my actually first appearance in the House in a different hat. And if I would have brought snacks, Mr. Chair, which I would have wanted to do.
We don't care about snacks. We just want you to be brief.
Would have been
next time, bring snacks.
All right, yeah. But I'm not allowed to, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm here representing Summa MRI in my own right in 36 years as a provider. And I agree with everything that's pretty much been said at the table. There's a few other parts you need to understand, Mr. Chair and members, about the whole no-fault matter. You may recall in 2012, I was the lead on with Senator Gazelka on the first successful no-fault task force that actually produced a product where people actually engaged. And so nobody I know favors fraudsters and Russian mafia and all the $50 million and all that. And so, but as you go on your no-fault fraud dealings and trying to reform, you have to remember that there are many players in the task. A loss occurs, people suffer either physical or property damage, and the goal is to restore them to their previous state of affairs. And if they can't be restored, they get some money. And that's pretty much the whole system. And it's lucky in Minnesota we still have no fault because the extensive damages that happen in these kind of injuries are far beyond what happens in the regular sprains that occur in the health plans, and it would cause an undue impact on those. So keeping no fault is my priority as well. And so, but as you work to reform this, and this is a part of that, you have to remember that there can be bad behavior on the parts of all three players in this world. The providers can be good or bad, auto companies can be good or bad, and the attorneys can be good or bad. I will suggest to you that the body of all three of those groups that behave in the normal day-to-day work is a good quality of work. But there are outliers on each. And as we attempt to reduce fraud, that doesn't mean there's criminal fraud, but in the day-to-day world of no fault, which is not related to criminal fraud, where there's still a lot of dialogue about how to do reform, you want to go after the outliers. And so there's a task force pending. You may hear that bill, Mr. Chair. And where you want to go after your fraud work that's really going to make a difference besides this overt stuff we're talking about today is in the outliers on the insurance companies who are unduly denying claims, providers who are unduly billing, patients who are complicit, or lawyers who are going along as well. But there's a far minority, and there's a lot of money in that. So I urge you as you go forward to think about that. To this bill, there's one element. I agree with the amendment. The bill is much better with the amendments brought forward, and I concur about that. But there is one more piece you want to know, and that's the evidence that the Commerce Fraud Department has to bring forward. It's on a preponderance. Preponderance means they probably did it. That's 51%. And so I want to tell you on the 49% that's remaining, There's lots of rooms for somebody maybe didn't do it. And so this is an administrative decision made by a person in a department who's going to decide to go forward on it with a charge or not. And some of these folks are pretty aggressive, and I've had my own constituents talk in the past about how they've fallen afoul of some guy in the Commerce Department, which is why I'm suggesting to you a better standard is clear and convincing. That 75%, I mean, most people would agree that they probably did do it. And all these fraudsters are talking about are clear that they did this act. And so I want to encourage you as this goes forward to kind of make it dolphin safe and make sure some innocent person who's in this doing this work isn't caught up in it.
Thank you, Mr. Abler. Mr. Franza, did you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chairman, yes. I will respond very briefly because I suspect if we're fortunate to get a re-referral today, this issue will come up in civil law as well.
It will.
But very, very briefly, the clear and convincing standard that Mr. Abler recommends is, if you want to Google it and see a plethora of law review articles, you will see things like unworkably vague, etc. It's under a lot of discussion in the legal community. But most importantly, the standard for this is the same standard for almost all state agencies. Brief civil law thing. Beyond a reasonable doubt is when the state is affecting one's liberty, incarceration, taking away your right to livelihood, banning you from having your job is clear and convincing. Everything else is generally the standard that we have here and that all state agencies have as well when they find people in the various pursuits.
Gentlemen, thank you. You are both right, and that's as far into civil law as we want to delve in deference to our chair and another committee. Mr. Carlson, did you want to
come forward? I'll be done.
Representative Abler, I thought you were done.
I'm sorry. I'm close to but I know this is a civil law matter, but I want the members of the committee.
Representative Abler, if it is a civil law matter, we are pressed for time.
Okay.
If you could hold it till civil law, that would be great. And I understand where you're going with it. I appreciate it. But I would say the same thing to Mr. Franzen. We're going to have opportunity to hear this in Representative Scott's committee.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Abler. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. And like others, of course, we oppose fraudulent activity. And we support providing tools for consumers and for the Department of Commerce and others to fight this crime. But our concern is, and always has been, that we don't stigmatize legal conduct with the odor of fraud. And a lot of that is what we think is going on here. And I've had literally thousands of conversations with Mr. Franzen over the years about this particular topic. And our concern is that when you look at the bill, and I'll just address the bill itself, the conduct that they're trying to preclude in Section 3 of the bill as it relates to the prohibition of contacting a person in via a written communication is completely different than the problem we had last year. Last year when we were here on this bill, the problem was fraudsters going down to the Department of Public Safety and buying the public record and going to the person's house and dragging them to the chiropractor. That conduct that everyone thought was offensive is not even precluded by this language. That was the biggest problem that we had. Now what this says is that if I get an accident report, I cannot send you a written communication. And of all of the communications, the ones I'm concerned about the most are the ones that you get about what your legal rights may be. And what this language says on lines 2.2 through the balance of the section on accident solicitation is that the insurance company can contact you in those first 30 days. The insurance company can settle with you in those first 30 days. But you are prohibited from getting any information, advertising or otherwise, about what your rights may be. And we just think that this, the way it's written, just puts the balance too far in favor of the insurance carriers opposed to your constituents who may need that information. And letters that go out, and I'm not defending flooding your mailbox with letters, but letters that go out to potential clients are governed by the Minnesota Board of Professional Responsibility for Lawyers, and they must clearly state that they are advertising. They must clearly state that you don't have a client relationship with the party that you're sending the mail to. It is simply getting information to a consumer that they've been injured and that they have rights. And that is what is precluded in this. At the same time, the insurance companies can settle with you. And that is our concern. It isn't that we're here to defend the fraudsters. I do, Mr. Chairman, have a couple other comments on the language of the bill. And I personally tend to think they're commerce-related issues. You may have a difference of opinion. But there are a couple changes from what was proposed in the Senate. And one of the concerns I have is that if you look on lines 1.6, it talks about the Commerce Fraud Bureau, which is governed by Minnesota Statute 45. The Fraud Bureau does not make findings of fact. They do not adjudicate. And so we are now saying, upon a recommendation of the Commerce Fraud Bureau, that the commissioner can impose an administrative penalty. And then it goes on to order restitution and what the fines may be. It doesn't really say that I'm entitled to an evidentiary hearing on the merits of what the Crime Bureau, Fraud Bureau, has indicated. And it does say on the top of page 2 on 2.1 that a hearing, if it were conducted, would be done in accordance with Chapter 14, but a hearing on what? On the penalty, which is how I read this, not on the merits. I think you need to clean up the language so that you get a hearing on the merits, which I don't believe is clear. The other thing that I would point out on this language that is different than the Senate and different than other versions I've looked at, on line 1.27, you will see that the definition of insurance fraud under 60A, 951 subdivision 4, is really fraud defined as someone submitting a claim to the insurance company. The previous versions, and also in this bill, deal with insurance fraud under the criminal code of 609-611. And that's where you get to agent fraud, that's where you get to company fraud, and that is now taken away from the Commerce Department under this definition because you are unable to prosecute that under this new crime if the agent misappropriates the premium. If the insurance company does something improper, that is now not governed because it is definitionally not covered under 60A 951 subdivision 4. Those, I think, Mr. Chairman, are commerce-related issues. Thank you for your time. Happy to answer questions.
Representative Lunin, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a statement regarding the 30-day wait. It's already statute in Minnesota under no fault that the insurance carrier has to send out a written notification of all of the coverage rights of the plaintiff. So they are, in fact, informed right away of all of the things that they have access to.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? Anybody else in the Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. France and I guess Representative Sanders, although it may not be your response. So we were hearing fairly large numbers on the amount of money that it was costing Minnesota consumers. So is it safe to assume that should something like this become law that we'll begin to see a reduction in what we pay for premiums?
Do you want me to handle that, anybody? Whoever wants to take it, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, or representative, I can say it will certainly have an impact on what the consumer pays in premiums, whether that means stemming the tide of inflation, whether it means reductions in some cases, which you did experience in the state of Florida when they passed their fraud reforms. I can't answer that. I can't speak for those companies and how they would do it. But what the simple economics is, here is a preventable cost imposed on the system. You take away that cost, the insurance company just can't pocket that $1,400. Our regulators would not permit that. So there will be a positive impact on rates, and that's all I can promise you.
Thank you, Mr. Franzen. Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against this before we give Representative Sanders the final word on this bill? Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. Again, I think it's going to civil law, and obviously we'll have a good discussion there. But I think this is a great bill. I appreciate all the folks that have worked towards compromise on the bill. I think the amendment makes the bill a lot stronger, and we look forward to your support.
Representative Sanders, well said. With that, Representative Sanders renews his motion that House File 864, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Sanders and members. Representative Nash. I will move House File 1502 as Representative Nash comes down. Oh, sorry. I have a typo here. House File 1509, Representative Nash. We are in a bit of a time crunch here. Welcome to the committee. Tell us, seriously, 4:20 in the afternoon, you represent distilleries and you're bringing us donuts? Okay. Now we got that in front of us. House File 1509 is in front of us. Representative Nash, please go ahead with your bill.
Mr. Chair, thank you, members. Thank you for hearing 1509. I would also move my DE amendment.
Representative Nash, I'll move the DE amendment.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, this House File 1509...
Actually, Representative Nash, we'll go ahead and vote on the DE amendment to get the bill the shape you want it in, and then we'll let you proceed. All those in favor of the DE... I'm sorry, is it DE1? The DE1 amendment, please signify by saying aye. Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The DE1 amendment is properly before us. Representative Nash, to your bill.
We do have other treats, but we're going to refrain from that. So, Mr. Chair, members... this is a bill to allow micro-distilleries to sell bottles off-sale, subject to the following requirements that are in there. They sell them at a premium over the wholesaler's charge. They prevent any rare bottle from being sold, so something that you can achieve or purchase anywhere else. If requested, the micro-distillery is also going to put a piece of advertisement in along with the bottle so that other purchasers can find retailers that they can buy a bottle at, or they can go to a fine restaurant and find out where those cocktails are being served. This enables small business owners like my constituent here, Mr. Miller, to sell and actually cash flow well their establishments. And Mr. Miller does have testimony, so I'm going to invite him to testify.
Thank you. Mr. Miller, welcome to the committee.
Thank you,
please,
Mr.
proceed
Chairman,
when you're ready.
Representatives,
state your name.
My name is Bill Miller. I'm the principal investor in the J. Carver Distillery in Waconia, Minnesota. And with me today is my partner and business manager, Gina Holman. I will make my comments briefer than I expected, given that we seem to be running a little slow here today. A few years ago, you guys made some changes to the laws in Minnesota that allowed some entrepreneurs to start up micro distilleries in the state of Minnesota. I'm just one of those people. There are several others in this room. We've invested millions of dollars and thousands of hours in a business located in the community of Waconia. In addition to the construction services we've invested in, large investments in equipment, J. Carver has already created many good-paying jobs. In addition, by purchasing our grains, grapes, and other products for our process in Minnesota, such as apples, barrels, labels, and others, we're also boosting other Minnesota businesses. In the less than 6 months since we commenced production, we've developed and introduced 5 products based on locally sourced inputs, and we plan to introduce another 10 products over the next 18 months, and they've been well received. Today I'm here to request that you consider some very modest changes in legislation that will allow the micro distilleries in Minnesota to continue to grow and contribute to the social and economic well-being of the state. It's my belief that if you support this legislation permitting on-site bottle sales, there will be significant benefits not only to my community, but for other businesses and other communities across the state of Minnesota that will also be positively impacted. This bill also provides elements to ensure that other Minnesota businesses are protected. So by allowing micro distilleries such as J. Carver to sell bottles on sale, there are really 2 benefits. One is to allow us to be on equal footing with competitors from other states who operate under more favorable regulations, yet they do business here in Minnesota. This bill will allow us to offer competitive products and services to tourists and travelers. So instead of driving to Wisconsin or Iowa people in Minnesota can come visit distilleries here in Minnesota and just stay here instead, and maybe people from Iowa and Wisconsin will come and visit us instead of the other way around. Equally important is having a competitive economic position so we can effectively compete for shelf space versus these outstate competitors. The second benefit is to provide consumers with the opportunity to experience our products and support our businesses when and how they desire. Almost every day since we've opened, we've had people stop by, knock on the window, ask for a tour, and want to taste our products. We've accommodated them whenever possible, and following our hospitality, most of them are surprised, if not frustrated, by the fact that we cannot sell a bottle of our product to them before they leave and run back home, just as they do in their state and at other breweries and wineries right down the road. We would like to expand significantly our ability to offer tours, but without the ability to sell our products on site, our investments are going to be limited, and the value and the experience of what we have to offer to Minnesotans coming by are not going to be competitive with other venues. We don't want our patrons to leave disappointed, frustrated. We want to do all we can to make sure they buy a bottle of our stuff and then go home and keep buying it at their liquor stores and at the restaurants where they live. Should you see fit to support this legislation, our ability to increase the investment in our business and increase the number of good jobs will be greatly increased. Instead of just one additional employee, we would be able to add several more. We'd have more hours we could be open for business, and instead of a couple hundred tourists a week, it would probably be in the thousands. This in turn is going to greatly benefit the surrounding restaurants and other attractions in our community. It would also benefit the many Minnesota businesses that supply our production process. Barrel makers in Avon and Park Rapids, grain suppliers in Plato, Clear Lake, Glencoe, and many other places, label producers in St. Paul and Minneapolis, and our distributor in Richfield. So to summarize, this proposed minor change in legislation would yield benefits to the emerging Minnesota microdistillery industry, the communities in which we operate, but to many other businesses across the state that serve the industry. We also think it would serve the Minnesota citizens that are eager to experience and visit us and taste and support the products we produce. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Ms. Holman, do you want to say anything?
No, thank you.
Just here for technical support?
I'm here to display.
You've done well.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that wants to come down? Anybody in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill? Members, any questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And let me start by saying that I don't drink, but when I do purchase alcohol, I look at the label, and usually a fine label is a fine alcoholic beverage, and I must say your labels are wonderful. Moving away from that, is there any provision in this law that would limit the amount of bottles other than paying 140% of what general wholesale price would be?
Representative Dean, good question. Representative Nash.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean, no, we did not put that in this piece of legislation.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, so there would be nothing that prohibit me from buying a case or two cases or four cases?
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, we did not put that in this language. I'm certainly willing to have a conversation, but looking through the bottles, no, we did not put that in there.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Thank you, Representative Nash. As with most of our bills today, this one I think is still somewhat fluid and a work in progress, and I thank all of you for that. Representative Sandin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I now understand why I don't trust Representative Dean. That said, just a statement that would apply to a couple of the bills that are before us today, you know, and I applaud you for starting up a new business and doing well at it, but just remind the committee that all these companies did start up under the current law, and they're just actually looking for more sales. Well, who's not? But as far as alcohol sales in the state of Minnesota, every time we open up another venue to buy from off-sale liquors, it affects an existing business. I'm certain of that, you know, and I've got a lot of my favorite liquor stores throughout the state that might take a beating. It might be a little bit of a nick, but all of a sudden enough nicks, and we're going to see those mom and pop liquor stores shut down at the expense of you know, to benefit your business. So I think there's room for everybody, and I don't think we have any responsibility as far as changing the laws to accommodate on-sale or off-sale in your facilities. So just a comment that pretty much covers two or three bills there today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sundin. I always appreciate your comments, and especially when you encompass two or three bills at once. That's good. We like that. Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd just like to remind the committee, the reason we got pastries was to soften up on bills.
I don't think there's any quid pro quo here, Representative Kreshaw.
It's just a suggestion of the committee, Mr. Chair.
Members, any other questions? Otherwise, I think we've got Mr. Carlson and Mr. Bagnoli that want to come down. Okay, they're going to come down and speak after all three of the bills. So, okay, my apologies. Thank you very much. We're going to go ahead and do we see Representative Franz in here? Okay, we're going to go ahead and lay over House File 1509 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus liquor bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. Appreciate your support.
Okay, Representative Lunan, we'll go next. Representative Franzen is voting on another bill in another committee, so we won't pass her bill. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Representative Lunan, if you'd like to go ahead and move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move
House File 1466. For possible inclusion in the omnibus liquor bill. Thank you.
Correct.
And if you tell us about your bill and if you want to introduce your testifiers or however you want to do it, please proceed.
Right. I've got some testifiers here, some distilleries. I've got Mr. Montana from Dunord Craft Spirits, Bob McManus from 11 Wells in Representative Johnson's district, and I've got Mr. and Mrs. Vickery from Vickery Distillery up in Duluth. And the premise of this bill it does a couple of things. First of all, it allows micro distilleries. What it's trying to do is to create an environment where they can compete for market share. The micro distilleries can sell off-sale products to people that come in to their shops. They're allowed to sell cocktails. And there's also a component in here that would allow them to distribute directly to the retailers. I know that there's some work being done on that yet, but at this point, that's the verbiage in the bill. And so I'm just going to hand it over to the testifiers for the sake of time.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. Nicely done. Whoever wants to go first, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, my name is Chris Montana. I'm the owner and head distiller of Dunord Craft Spirits. We're a small micro distillery in Minneapolis, and we recently opened the Twin Cities' first cocktail room. And so my first point is to thank this body for moving that legislation through. We've seen a significant benefit to our business. It's allowed us to go from me being in the back room to now we have 9 employees, and we're looking to add some more. And we're before you today to hopefully argue our case as to why some of these changes might allow us to do just that. Just to give you an idea here, because you're going to have 3 different bills that are in front of you that are playing all on the same field, I'll just give a brief overview of who we are, then I'll kick it to my colleagues who will dig a little bit more into the details. But we're here representing the Minnesota Distillers Guild. We're an organization of 14 micro distilleries, some small, and as far as micro distilleries go, some very large. We are spread out throughout the state, as far north as Halleck, Minnesota. Northfield, obviously several in the Twin Cities. There are 14 of us. There are many more that are on their way. To this point, we've been met with an awful lot of energy and enthusiasm, and that energy and enthusiasm has been at least somewhat tempered or muted when people find out the things that we are not able to do. And so we're here today just asking for parity, nothing more and nothing less than what the other producers in the state are able to do. And with that, I'd like to kick it over to Joel and Emily Vigra.
Thank you, Mr. Montana. Whoever wants to go first, whenever you're ready, please identify yourselves from the record and proceed.
We'll pass this around. It's more delicious than soda.
Let the record record state that the bottle is not open.
No, it is not open. We'll check it when it gets back. My name is Emily Vikra, and this is my husband, Joel Vikra.
Representative Sundin, you need to share. please proceed.
And we are the co-founders of Vikra Distillery. We are up in Duluth, Minnesota, in Canal Park, right at the foot of the lift bridge. And we have been open for just over a year now. We've been distributing for just over a year now. And in that time, we have created 9 jobs in Duluth, and we are actively trying to hire 3 more. So if anybody is looking for a different vocation, talk to us. But in that time, we have also become an integral part of the tourist economy in Duluth. Since we opened our doors to people visiting in last June, we've seen over 5,000 people, and that's without even having a sign out. And people come in and are able to experience this true Minnesota industry where we're using Minnesota ingredients and making a product that is evocative of this place and something that Minnesotans can be really proud of. And definitely speaking to Chris's point, the changes that have already been made to support microdistilleries, the tastings, the cocktails, have been really integral in helping us get going and giving people that experience. But I would say out of the 5,000 people that we've seen so far, probably 4,998 have asked to buy a bottle from us, and we've had to say no. And in the states that have a vibrant craft distilling industry, those states, if you look at them, Washington, Oregon, Colorado, all allow direct bottle sales to consumers. And actually, pretty much all of those states have no limitations on the format or on the pricing of those bottles, but have seen no negative impacts on the retailers or the wholesalers in those states. Washington does have a limit on volume, which is 3 liters per person per day. The states that have had more severe restrictions have not seen the type of boom in that craft economy that the states that have created a supportive legislative environment have seen. And Joel is going to give you a little bit of a breakdown as to why, for a small nascent industry in our businesses, direct bottle sales as a small portion of our sales is such an important thing.
Thank you, and I appreciate it. And I hate to do this. It's the builder's fault. Sorry, Representative Tice. But we're kind of running up against the time, so if you could hit the highlights, we would greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair. If everyone has this form in front of them, this shows the breakdown of one bottle of our gin on the shelf. The shelf price is $31.99. And if you look at the bottom there, variable costs are about $10 of that. The majority of that goes to Minnesota agricultural products. If you look at the red sections, that is tax. And then the three in the middle there, retailer, distributor, micro distillery, shows roughly how much money from each bottle goes to those three tiers of the system. Those ratios are the result of sort of ongoing legislative discussions since the end of Prohibition, and we sort of follow in that tradition today. In this past year, we sold a little over 3,000 cases. And to give you a sense of what that means, that generated over $75,000 in state tax. It generated $140,000 for retailers in the state, and it generated about $77,000 for our distributor. However, for us, even though we're at 3,000 cases, we still haven't hit our break even. And we're discovering what has been true for craft distilling industries across the country, which is that direct bottle sales are an absolutely necessary factor for success. Now, there's two ways of looking at the conflicts that are going to come up. One is zero sum, and the other is rising tide. The zero sum argument is that if we're able to sell some bottles directly, then that $140,000 that right now goes to, that we made for retailers this year, that we're going to take some of that and there will be no more. And if I was a retailer and I believe that's true, I would definitely be fighting this legislation. But I don't think that's true. What we've seen in other states is a rising tide. So when distilleries are able to sell their bottles, consumers come to those distilleries, they buy a bottle, they go home and they buy other bottles at their local liquor store. They get cocktails made with that stuff at local bars. And they are now educated and sensitized and looking for other craft products, which are higher margin products for their local retailers. So what we see is if a year from now we're not able to do bottle sales, it might be $140 to the retailer, or we might not have hit our break-even point and it might be zero. If we are allowed to do bottle sales, I believe we'll continue to grow. That $140 for retailers will continue to grow, and also we'll have enough money to for our business to succeed.
Thank you. Do we have one more testifier?
Thank you very much. In the interest of time, ladies and gentlemen of the Commerce Committee, I'm Robert McManus, founder and president of 11 Well Spirits of St. Paul, located in the once vacant Hams Brewery. I'd like to say thank you for listening to my testimony. and also recognize a few faces around. Thank you for coming to visit over at 11 Wells about a month ago, and a number of the distillers were over there to show some of the both House and Senate committee members what we do. And earlier I did bring treats, as we see up here. First thing I would like to say is that we take commodity, and actually this I'll touch on this in a moment. This is not a commodity. This is a specialty corn here. We take both corn, specialty and commodity crops, turn them into products that are worth much more than the inputs. First, just allow me to share a conversation I had at my daughter's gym class last night, gymnastics class, that got me thinking about the future of commerce and industry in Minnesota. In speaking to another dad there, Rob, while watching the girls do their exercises, our conversation turned to employment. I told Rob what I did, and he said, "Hey, my father worked at the Hams Brewery." And the next thing he said to me is, "Wow, you're in a tough business." And he said, as he was growing up on the east side, he worked at Morelli's liquor store, and that the Morellis are family friends of theirs. So, as if perhaps to provide some balance to this, he said that Jimmy Morelli said to him very recently that the craft beer explosion, in his opinion, is nowhere near an end. I think that's great news for all of us in this room. To get to the point about a bottle sale provision, this would simply provide parity for liquor distillers with current laws on the books for beer brewers and winemakers, essentially a Surly bill for liquor. And we all know what the Surly bill did for commerce in the beer industry. For the benefit of the Commerce Committee members who weren't able to visit with us last month, let me share with you that distilleries strongly support Minnesota agriculture with grain and oak barrel purchases, as others have pointed out. In fact, over 90% of the raw materials that we use to ferment come directly from Minnesota farms. This is actually a substantially higher percentage than beer and winemakers in the state. Passage of this bill would allow us to generate cash that we would use to continue to grow the business and further our revitalization efforts at Hams and hire more staff in addition to the 5 that we currently have. This corn is a heritage Minnesota 13 corn. It got the name because it was the 13th trial of corn done nearby at the U in 1888 that matured in less than 90 days. Before this open pollinated corn was developed, corn was not commercially grown in Minnesota. Imagine that. I had two different growers last year that it took us 2 years to find, and they grew this corn for us. You can't find this corn out in the market. It's a specialty. We pay a premium over regular corn.
Mr. McManus,
yes.
I hate to do this, but I'm going to ask you to cut it short because I'm going to have to let everybody go here in a minute because we've got to go over to the House floor.
Okay.
So I appreciate the testimony.
That's fine.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. Time. And I apologize for the shortness of time. It's my fault. I didn't push enough earlier. Representative Lunan will give you a very quick final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, the onus of this bill is to allow a balanced field for competition for the micro distilleries. We'd appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. Thank you, all of you. And with that, we will lay House File 1466 over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Liquor Bill. And we'll welcome Representative Friends into the committee. Our last bill and our last liquor bill of the day, Representative Franzen, I will move House File 962 so it is in front of us. And if you and your testifier want to come up, start whenever you're ready. Mr. McManus, I was kind of hoping you were going to forget those. Thank you. Representative Franzen, go ahead when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll make this quick. Panther Distillery is back. If you recall, 2 years ago, they were here in front of this committee regarding sampling. This time, they are coming forward to do we could consider it more of a novelty size of some product, and I will let the owner of Panther Distillery state his case, if you'll state.
Good afternoon. My name's Adrian Panther. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members, and Representative Franzen. Thank you very much. Thank you so very much for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Adrian Panther, of course, and I am the owner of Panther Distillery, the first legal whiskey distillery in Minnesota. We are located in west central Minnesota in the city of Osakis, population 1,700. Since we opened our doors 4 years ago, we've seen exciting things happen in our small town. An increase in local tourism, the addition of two restaurants, and a grocery store. Last September, the city collaborated with our distillery to host an event called Moonshine Madness, which showcased our community and Minnesota's connection to the Prohibition era. It was hugely successful and is set to be an annual event again this September 12th in Osakis. Panther Distillery has six full-time and one part-time employee. I have only been able to give one pay increase to my employees since we opened 4 years ago. My staff are all loyal and believe in what we are doing to grow in the future. So I come to you today asking for your approval on a sale of a small souvenir bottle to sell in our gift shop. The bottle sale I'm requesting is a 375 milliliter size, which is half the size of bottles normally sold. With this additional revenue, I will be able to make my tourist operations cash flow itself and cover all its costs. I see souvenir bottles as a great marketing tool. Visitors can come purchase our bottle in the gift shop and take it home with them to share with family and friends to further promote Minnesota-made products and our company. This small bottle represents Minnesota, and I see it as a piece of Minnesota that will travel all over the country as tourists take it home with them. A Minnesota brand is what we are. We use the water and locally grown corn, wheat, rye, and even Minnesota-made barrels to create our product. We are excited about what we are doing and hope you will nurture our growth by allowing for a sale of a 357 millimeter bottle. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Panther. We have Mr. Bagnoli and guests want to speak.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Joe Bagnoli on behalf of the MLBA and the Minnesota Municipal Beverage Association. I have with me today Joe and Danielle Butler with the Good Time Liquor Store from Norwood Young America, and we know the time limits.
Thank you, Mr. Bagnoli. Please identify yourself for the record and start when you're ready.
I'm Joe Butler. I brought my wife here, Danielle, today to speak with you all today on the distillery bill that's being represented. We are second generation owners of a small liquor store in Carver County. My father-in-law started the business 28 years ago, and I'm proud to continue serving our customers today. My father-in-law and my wife make business decisions every day that set on the current set of rules on the three-tiered system. Minnesota is obviously doing something right. Under our current regulations, we have alcohol prices below the national average, plentiful liquor stores, a thriving micro distillery industry, as well as craft brewing and small business owners that are able to compete. And unfairly changing the rules, which we have made our business decisions on liquor stores, also specific rules, times we can be open, who we can sell products to, and who we can purchase our products from. Changes in the current rules cheat us. It tips the scales to help only a few at the expense of many. It changes the level playing field and would negatively affect my business and upset our three-tiered system. I urge your support, our smart, balanced system, and stand up for small business like mine. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. Mrs. Butler, do you want to? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe Bagnoli, again, on behalf of the MLBA and MMBA, we have grave concerns about these the series of bills you've heard. Spirits are a distinct and different type of alcohol than wine and beer, and the restrictions that are contained on wine and beer are not contained in this. This is a significant departure from the current system that we are concerned about and we are opposed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bagnoli. Mr. Carlson, and thank you, Mr. and Mrs. Butler. Mr. Carlson, Mr. Reynoso.
You got your clock ready, John?
Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Wine and Spirit Distributors in Minnesota. And much like the proponents, our association members are family-owned, self-started entrepreneurs that have built their businesses in Minnesota based on our current three-tier system. We support the previous comments about the system, and the three-tier system provides a bright line, and we think that's appropriate between manufacturer, wholesaler, and distiller, and we support that regulation. As wholesalers, we also totally support these businesses through our network of distribution across the state of Minnesota, and we are not aware of market restrictions or the inability to find a market for any of these companies, and if there are, I'm happy to provide them my business card and number when we're done. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Reynoso, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Edward Reynoso, I'm the political director for Teamsters Joint Council 32, and just to be brief, we always have concerns when there's any type of expansion of off-sale and the fact that it doesn't impact the wholesale, our wholesalers, in which we employ many members. And there was one question that came up from Representative Dean, and I know he's not here now, but one of the concerns we also have is that there's no limits on this bill whatsoever. And if you think about the craft brew industry and the growlers, there certainly is limits on the growlers. 500 barrels, I believe. And so, you know, some of our concern is that there are no safeguards in there. I know there's one bill that doesn't have any language whatsoever as to what the max somebody could buy at one point, but there's no safeguards whatsoever on a yearly max. So with that, thank you for your time.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your comments. Representative Franzen, we'll give you the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Regarding the comment from Mr. Carlson, our bill, House File 962, an individual would only be able to purchase one 375-milliliter bottle per product.
It.
Yes, there we go. So it's not unlimited. Okay. They are limited to just one. So thanks, and I appreciate this opportunity.
Members and guests, thank you very much for your patience. We are a bit over time, and with that, we will lay House File 962 over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Liquor Bill. Thanks again for your patience. We are adjourned.